morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 16, and here are some of the stories we are covering. President Biden welcomes the ceasefire agreement between Hamas and Israel.
It includes a full and complete ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli forces from all the populated areas of Gaza, and the release of a number of hostages held by Hamas, including women and elderly and the wounded.
We'll have an analysis of the ceasefire agreement. Joe Biden also delivers his final speech as president from the White House. The son of a former Malawi president will explain why he's running for the same high office this year. Botswana records grim statistics on gender-based violence. Mozambique's president is sworn in amid tight security and protests.
Now, a big challenge that he has is how he's going to handle this political instability, because taking office is not all, it's just the beginning.
And the Nigeria-America Chamber of Commerce appeals to incoming Trump administration to renew AGOA and PEPFAR. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. President Joe Biden Wednesday night delivered his farewell address to the nation. From the White House, VOA's Douglas Mpuga listened to the speech and has this report.
In his farewell address to the nation delivered from the Oval Office, President Biden highlighted the achievements of his administration, but began his address by hailing the ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas.
A ceasefire and a hostage deal has been reached by Israel and Hamas, the elements of which I laid out in great detail in May this year. This plan was developed and negotiated by my team and will be largely implemented by the incoming administration. That's why I told my team to keep the incoming administration fully informed, because that's how it should be, working together as Americans. This is a people. Our system of separation of powers, checks and balances, it may not be perfect, but it's maintained our democracy for nearly 250 years, longer than any other nation in history that's ever tried such a bold experiment. In the past 4 years, our democracy has held strong. And every day I've kept my commitment to be president for all Americans through one of the toughest periods in our nation's history. The determination of advocates standing up for our rights and our freedoms instead of losing their jobs to an economic crisis that we inherited. Millions of Americans now have the dignity of work. Millions of entrepreneurs and companies creating new businesses and industries, hiring American workers, using American products. Together, we've launched a new era of American possibilities, one of the greatest modernizations of infrastructure in our entire history, from new roads, bridges, clean water, affordable high-speed internet, for every American.
Biden served 36 years in the U.S. Senate, one of the longest Senate careers in the chamber's history, before joining former President Barack Obama's ticket during the 2008 election and serving as vice president for 8 years.
My eternal thanks to you, the American people. After 50 years of public service, I give you my word. I still believe in the idea for which this nation stands. Nation where the strength of our institutions and the character of our people matter and must endure. Now it's your turn to stand guard. May you all be the keeper of the flame. May you keep the faith. I love America. You love it too. God bless you all. May God protect your troops. Thank you for this great honor.
The 46th president defeated Trump during the 2020 election, but abruptly dropped out of the 2024 presidential race. He quickly endorsed Vice President Kamala Harris to take up the mantle as the party's presidential nominee. But she lost the election as Trump swept all seven battleground states. The farewell address is a tradition that dates back to George Washington. Biden will officially exit the Oval Office on January 20th, when President-elect Trump will be sworn in as the 47th president. Douglas Mpuga in Washington.
The Prime Minister of Qatar announced that Israel and Hamas had agreed to a ceasefire deal that promised the release of dozens of hostages held by Hamas and the return of hundreds of thousands of people displaced in Gaza to their homes. Linda Grastin reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The deal was reached after mediation by Qatar, Egypt, and the U.S. President Biden welcomed the deal.
The deal is structured in three phases. Phase one will last 6 weeks. It includes a full and complete ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli forces from all the populated areas of Gaza, and the release of a number of hostages held by Hamas, including women and elderly and the wounded. And I'm proud to say Americans will be part of that hostage release in phase one as well.
On the streets of Gaza, Palestinians celebrated the ceasefire, which will end the fighting for 42 days, see the release of dozens of Israeli hostages and hundreds of Palestinian prisoners, and give more humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza who have been suffering a humanitarian crisis. The Palestinians in Gaza have paid the heaviest price for the war with Israel, which began almost 16 months ago when Hamas invaded Israel. The Hamas-run health ministry says Israel has killed more than 46,000 Palestinians since then. Mu'tasim al-Namruti, a resident of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, welcomed the ceasefire. We have been waiting for this joyful moment, he said. We have been at war for a long time. In a televised address, acting Hamas leader Khalil al-Hayya said that Israel failed to achieve its goals in Gaza. On the streets of Tel Aviv, some also celebrated. The Hostage Family Forum called it a significant step forward that brings us closer to seeing all the hostages return. However, they said in a statement, they also have deep anxiety and concern regarding the possibility that the agreement might not be fully implemented and hostages would be left behind. Demonstrator Nofar Honigman said she was cautiously optimistic.
And we really hope that no one will mess it up, not in our side, not in their side. Wait for this very, very needed thing to happen, for the war to stop, for the hostages to come home.
The Israeli government is expected to approve the deal on Thursday, and it will take effect on Sunday. Israeli press reports say that on Sunday, the first three hostages are to be released. Hamas has refused to say how many of the 33 women, children, and elderly who are to be freed in the first stage of the deal are still alive. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Hamas and Israel have reached a multi-phase ceasefire that will lead to the release of some hostages held by the militant group for more than a year. Samir Shihata is the associate professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He tells me that the ceasefire is long overdue.
There have been multiple reports that Hamas agreed to essentially the same deal that was put forward by President Biden largely months ago. But Mr. Netanyahu and the Israeli right-wing government felt that they hadn't achieved their goals. They felt that the American administration had given them carte blanche to do anything they wanted to. And they aggressively and violently pursued not only Hamas, but the Palestinian population over the last several months. And so it's unfortunate that the ceasefire didn't happen a long time ago. But of course, I think everyone is relieved that it is taking place now.
And so that raises the question, why now? Why did it happen now?
I believe it happened now for a number of reasons, primarily with the incoming administration. President Trump signaled some time ago that he wanted a peace agreement done and the hostages back, quote unquote, before his inauguration. And he made statements about this. It seems that he made threatening statements about this. It seems like he was willing to apply some pressure to Mr. Netanyahu. And so that is the primary reason why the ceasefire is taking place now.
So what happens now? My understanding is that this has to be approved by the Israeli Security Cabinet. How likely that this will take place or happen soon?
Yes, the Israeli president has already said that the cabinet and Prime Minister Netanyahu will be meeting in a day, I believe, to approve this, and he's urged them to approve it. And with the Biden announcement today that this is a done deal, I think it's unlikely that the Israeli government will not approve it, will reject it. There's a tremendous amount of attention. There's some pressure on Israel, a little bit of pressure on Israel. So I think it's likely to be approved. And then the first phase will be implemented. There are already celebrations in Israel as well as in Gaza. Of course, the hostage families and those supporting them have wanted this for some time. So it would be exceedingly difficult to imagine Mr. Netanyahu not accepting it right now.
You mentioned earlier, Professor, the involvement of the incoming Trump administration. The thing is now, who is claiming responsibility for the success for this deal to take place? Or can we say this is an achievement of American diplomacy?
I don't know if I would say it's an achievement of American diplomacy, because if it's an achievement, it's an achievement that has left over 45,000 Palestinians dead. It has, you know, decimated Gaza, has caused tremendous upheaval in the region. So that's not much of an achievement. But as they say, success has many fathers and failure has none, and so on. So yes, the Biden administration is going to take credit for their work. Trump is going to take credit as well. Of course, the Qatari mediators and the Egyptian mediators also were involved. And so I think that, you know, the outcome is a result of multiple factors. But the primary immediate factor for why it took place today, as opposed to 5 days from now or 3 months ago, is the incoming Trump administration and that deadline that he kind of put with extra threats, as it were, that if a deal hadn't been done and if the hostages weren't released, that I think he said there would be, quote, hell to pay and so on, and it would be bad for the Middle East. So that's the primary immediate factor.
Atta is the Associate Professor of Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, January 16th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Under tight security measures, Mozambique's new president, Daniel Chapo, was sworn in on Wednesday as the country's fifth president. The ceremony took place as hundreds of demonstrators gathered in continuing protest against an election that they say was rigged. Charles Maguiro reports from Maputo.
Around 2,500 guests, including the presidents of South Africa and Guinea-Bissau, endured intense heat Wednesday as Daniel Chapo took his oath to become Mozambique's president for the next 5 years. Official results showed the 48-year-old Chapo winning the October election with about 65% of the votes. However, opposition parties rejected the result, and for close to 10 weeks, Mozambique has endured large street protests as well as violent crackdown by security forces. Presidential runner-up Venancio Mondlane has been leading the push for protests on social media, demanding what he calls the restoration of the electoral truth. The European Union and some Western countries, including the United States, have also questioned the credibility of the elections. The unrest has left at least 300 people dead, according to local and international human rights organizations. While Chapo took the oath of office Wednesday, hundreds of supporters of Mozambique's opposition leader protested on streets near the Maputo City Hall. Chapo inherits a country ravaged by corruption and deep economic challenges, including high unemployment and frequent job strikes by civil servants such as teachers, nurses, and doctors. In his speech Wednesday, Chapo called corruption a disease that has corroded the tissue of our state and our people.
Falemos da corrupção. Essa doença tem corroído o tecido do nosso...
The new president said this has to end. There is no place in this government nor in this country for anyone who puts his interest above those of the people. We will fight until the end to defend the interest of the Mozambican people in all sectors, public and private. Chapo, whose Frelimo party has been in power for almost 50 years, promised a leaner government by reducing some ministries and senior government positions. He said that could save over $260 million, which could be redirected towards improving the lives of people. Political analyst Evaristo Kumbani says the new president is facing an uphill climb, one that includes winning the confidence of foreign investors and pacifying the country.
Now, a big challenge that he has is how he's going to handle this political instability. Because taking office is not all, it's just the beginning. You know, he doesn't have the popular support, and his opponent, Venancio Mondlane, claiming that his votes were robbed. He's going to continue with his protests and until the truth is revealed. So let's see how he's going to handle. I believe that he's going to invite Venancio to sit with him and see what it will be the way out. So if they manage to do that, then the country will be back.
Fernando Lima, the political editor of the independent weekly Savannah, says the only way to end the ongoing protest is for President Chapo to talk to Mondlane. Mondlane last week returned to the country after almost 3 months of self-imposed exile.
He is the one that has the capacity to help in solve the political bottlenecks the country is facing and is probably the most important political actor in entertaining dialogue with government and Frelimo.
Along with post-election protests, Chapo will have to contend with a jihadist insurgency in the oil and gas-rich northern province of Cabo Delgado that has killed 6,000 people and left 2 million others internally displaced. Charles Mangwiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
In Malawi, Atupile Muluzi, the son of former President Bakili Muluzi, says he's running for president to bring about transparency, accountability, the rule of law, and a diversified economy. Malawi is one of about 20 African countries that will hold either a presidential or parliamentary election this year. Some Malawians believe the younger Muluzi would not be independent from his father if he becomes the president. Atupile Muluzi, the leader of the United Democratic Front, the UDF party, tells me that there is a lot to learn from all living former presidents to see what they did right and wrong. He tells me that he has his own vision for the development of Malawi.
First and foremost, I think it's important to highlight that Malawi is currently the fourth poorest country in the world when it should not be there. Our GDP is around $14 billion. And with a population of 20 million, that makes it, that is very low. And I think Malawi should not be at number four poorest country in the world. What we will do is understanding where the challenge is coming from. And it all stems from leadership. And this is why I'm standing for president in Malawi, because I believe that by providing strategic direction, especially with regards to corruption, corruption has had a massive impact on Malawi's growth. It has also made it very difficult for Malawi to grow its economy since 1964, since independence. Our vision is making sure that we decisively deal with corruption. We are also very much focused on a digital economy, a green economy. I'm someone from a younger generation that is looking at the potential that is existing that could help and assist a country like Malawi to leapfrog by using modern technology. But in terms of priorities, when we come in, the needed priorities would be stabilization of the economy.
Let me ask you about corruption, because if you talk to President Lazarus Chakwera's government officials, they tell you that the president's anti-corruption policies continue to bear fruit. So what would you do differently?
The corruption and rent-seeking has been a massive challenge since, I think, the time we attained independence. And I think this has had a huge impact on our ability to develop as a nation. The last 5 years under President Chakwera, we have also seen this become very prevalent. I must say, and I'd like to point this out, I have served in government in various senior leadership positions for close to 20 years. I definitely operated in an ecosystem where there was corruption. But you will find that I have come out of that untainted by corruption. There's never been any allegations of corruption against myself, and I've stood very strongly and firmly against corruption.
What do you say to those Malawians who are concerned that your father and a former president, Bakili Muluzi, may be heavily influential on you if you become the president?
President Muluzi was president of Malawi over 20 years ago. After his presidency, you've noticed that I have been in public office in politics for close to 20 years. And throughout my time, I've demonstrated to the people of Malawi that I am someone that is focused. I have my own vision for the development of the country. Very radically different from my father's time. I come from a different generation. He was a man of his time. We're now talking about the different ways of leadership. So let's be fair. He is a former president. There are three former presidents that are in Malawi. My father and the two other former presidents have some experience to share in terms of what they may have done wrong during their periods of time, and I've sat at what they could have done better. And this is a learning point for us as we start looking to develop a better future for Malawi.
Bukile Muluzi is the leader of the opposition United Democratic Front, the UDF party of Malawi. He was speaking with us from Lilongwe. Dozens more people have been injured and many displaced in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo in recent clashes between the Congolese army and the M23 fighters, local sources and NGOs told the French news agency AFP on Wednesday. The Rwanda-backed M23, considered a terrorist movement by Kinshasa, has seized vast swaths of territory in Eastern DRC since its resurgence in 2021. The World Health Organization says an outbreak of suspected Marburg disease has killed 8 people in a remote part of northern Tanzania. The Associated Press reports that WHO Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said in a statement early Wednesday that the group is aware of 9 cases so far, including 8 people who have died. He said he expects more cases to be found in the coming days. And that's it for this Thursday, January 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming on board with us this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV show, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I am James Barton in Washington saying, have a great day. And please be safe, whatever you do.
Voice of America on January 20th for comprehensive coverage of the presidential inauguration ceremonies as President-elect Donald John Trump takes the oath of office. From live reporting to expert analysis, VOA brings you every moment as history unfolds. Stay informed, stay connected, only on the Voice of America. Monday, January 20th, the 47th President of the United States, Donald John Trump, will be sworn into office. VOA will be there and will broadcast the events of the presidential inauguration live, starting at 1600 UTC, to audiences around the world.
I pledge that I will be president for all Americans.
Tune in right here on the